I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to another newly recorded episode of Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean of Berkeley Law. His latest book is We the People, A Progressive Reading of the Constitution for the 21st Century. You can learn more at law.berkeley.edu. After a three-year hiatus, I've been doing a new interview every other week since Trump's Electoral College victory. This is the 41st. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land, The Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on Why He's a Buddhist. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. Erwin Chemerinsky became Dean of Berkeley Law in mid-2017. From 2008 to 2017, he was the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at UC Irvine School of Law. Prior to that, he was a law professor at Duke University, and before that, at the University of Southern California Law School. In 2017, National Jurist magazine named him as the most influential person in legal education in the United States for the second year in a row. He is the author of more than 200 law review articles. His books include The Conservative Assault on the Constitution, The Case Against the Supreme Court, and his latest, as I said, We the People, A Progressive Reading of the Constitution for the 21st Century. Welcome, Erwin Chemerinsky, to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this interview Wednesday, December 12th, 2018.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk with you again.
Okay. Could you tell us briefly about the new book you just published this year?
I think it's important that progressives articulate and defend a vision of the Constitution. We're at a time of a very conservative Supreme Court. It's going to be that way for the foreseeable future. We are having increasingly conservative federal courts of appeals. Donald Trump will have had 30 nominees confirmed for the federal court of appeals in his first 2 years. Barack Obama had 55 confirmed in 8 years. George W. Bush had 62 confirmed in 8 years. It's likely that a significant percentage of the federal judiciary will be appointed by Donald Trump. In light of this, I think the question is, what are progressives going to do? And I wanted to write a book saying we should not give up a progressive vision of the Constitution. We should articulate it. We should defend it.
Okay. And briefly, your thoughts about the refusal to deal with Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland and then the subsequent recent confirmation hearings of Brett Kavanaugh.
What happened with regard to Merrick Garland was unprecedented in American history. 24 times in American history prior to 2016, there's a vacancy near the last year of a president's term. In 21 of 24 instances, the nominee got confirmed. In 3 instances, the Senate didn't confirm. But never before had the Senate said, no hearings, no vote.
So let me just remind people what you just said, that the Republicans, especially when it comes to judicial, claim they're originalists, claim that they, are the Constitution as written, blah, 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 and yet were willing to take an unprecedented action never before in the history of the Union. And as you said, 24 times a vacancy had turned up within the last year of a president's term. Any thoughts about the confirmation hearings of Brett Kavanaugh? I would say specifically maybe the question of temperament as displayed in those hearings.
The nomination of Brett Kavanaugh led to a confirmation battle that in so many ways was unprecedented in American history. There's really never been anything like what we saw. There's never been a closer vote for a nominee. Kavanaugh was confirmed 50-48. The prior closest vote for confirmation was for Clarence Thomas, which was 52-48, which was back in 1991. But the partisanship, the lack of judicial temperament that was shown on that day in October really has no analog in American history. For Brett Kavanaugh to say this was all a smear by those who support the Clintons and to make it so blatantly political really doesn't have any precedent.
Yeah, and what we're saying there is that this notion that the judiciary is impartial, the judiciary is nonpartisan, He, in his own statements on national television, not just in a closed hearing, everyone saw he was willing to make political statements about those hearings and about his confirmation. This is going to be a simple one, a softball, Erwin Chemerinsky. What are your expectations of this newly constituted conservative court? And take your time if you want to place it in the context of the cycles back and forth of conservative and progressive, Supreme Courts.
I think we're going to have the most conservative court that there's been since the mid-1930s. I think we're going to see it especially as the most high-profile controversial issues. I think there's now 5 votes to either explicitly or effectively overrule Roe versus Wade. There are 5 votes now to eliminate all forms of affirmative action. There are 5 votes now to very much limit gay and lesbian rights. In terms of history, eras on the Supreme Court last a long time. There was an era from the 1890s to 1936 where there was a very conservative court that struck down over 200 federal, state, and local laws affecting workers and consumers. From 1937 to 1969, there was a court that had a majority of justices appointed by Democratic presidents. It became increasingly more liberal, especially in the 1960s under Chief Justice Earl Warren. The court's next era began in 1969 when Richard Nixon had 2 nominees confirmed. From 1969 until February 13, 2016, when Justice Scalia died, there were always at least 5 and sometimes as many as 8 justices appointed by Republican presidents. But all during this time, there was a swing justice on the court. There was a Lewis Powell, a Sandra Day O'Connor, and Anthony Kennedy to join with the liberals in some of those controversial areas I mentioned. Now there's no longer a swing justice. Now there are 5 very ardent conservatives in the majority. And we're going to see the manifestation of that with regard to things like abortion, affirmative action, gay and lesbian rights, punishment in criminal cases.
Mm-hmm. And you, in some of the articles I've read recently, you make clear how much Kennedy was the swing justice on the one hand. On the other hand, that he voted with the conservatives 75% of the time. How do we demonstrate how clearly he was the swing?
Well, just what you said, when the court was split 5-4 over the last 30 years, Kennedy was with the conservatives 75% of the time, with the liberals 25% of the time. 2 years ago, when the court was split 5-4 or 5-3, Kennedy was the liberals 57% of the time, and the conservatives 43% of the time. But I think qualitatively is even more important than quantitatively.
Mm-hmm.
You look at abortion. 2 years ago, Kennedy was the 5th vote to strike down a law in Texas that would have closed most facilities in that state where abortion is performed. 2 years ago, it was Kennedy who wrote the opinion upholding the University of Texas Affirmative Action Program. In every Supreme Court decision in American history expanding rights for gays and lesbians, Kennedy wrote the majority opinion.
Okay. In the past, there have been ideological surprises in the Supreme Court. And Earl Warren was appointed by Eisenhower. Some that were thought, I know there was one you mentioned that was told, this guy's a home run. Maybe that was Souter. And he ended up being much more middle of the road than that, a home run conservative. We don't expect surprises from Gorsuch or Kavanaugh. Why not?
First, surprises are relatively unusual. Felix Frankfurter was a liberal who became very conservative on the court. Harry Blackmun was a conservative who became liberal. But those are the rare exceptions. Most people don't have major ideological transformation when they're in their 50s, 60s, 70s. Clarence Thomas was very conservative and he came on the court in 1991. He's just as conservative today. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was liberal when she came on the court in 1993. She's no different today. And we go through so many examples of people who, throughout their career, were very much ideologically the same. Second, there's much more screening for ideology at this point than there's been at prior points in history. Dwight Eisenhower was not a particularly ideologically defined president. The Republican, he picked a Democrat, William Brennan, for the court. I don't think that Earl Warren was a surprise. He'd just never been a judge before, so we didn't know much about his judicial record. But I think biographies of Warren show us that what he did as a justice very much followed what he'd been as a governor and as attorney general. David Souter was a surprise, but it's because no one knew much about what he was going to say on the controversial issues. John Sununu told President George H.W. Bush that Souter would be a home run, but it turned out that Souter was much more liberal than anyone realized. But it's not that he changed once on the court.
Okay. Now, it's my assessment, and I'm not alone. I've been, you know, reading on this and so on for a long time, that the Constitution as a document is, I'm going to say, weaker than many believe. It has more holes than many believe, and that Republicans over the last decade, certainly, have been doing a really good job of taking advantage of those gaps, those weaknesses. Is that a reasonable assessment?
The Constitution is written in very open-ended language. It was written in 1787 for an agrarian slave society. There are countless issues that have to be resolved that the Constitution doesn't speak to. Can the president fire a member of the cabinet? Can the president rescind a treaty? There's nothing in the Constitution about those. Or think about, when can the government regulate the Internet? There's obviously nothing in the Constitution about that at that level of specificity. I think that conservatives have done a very good job of putting forth the rhetoric that conservative judges just apply the law. They don't make the law. They're just umpires. And what liberals need to argue, and what I try to argue in my book, is that's nonsense. Constitutional law is inevitably, in terms of the decisions of the Supreme Court, a function of who are the justices. That's why conservatives fought so hard to get Brett Kavanaugh there. That's why conservatives fought so hard to block Merrick Garland. The recognition of who's on the bench determines the outcome of the cases. And in my book, I try to argue that it very much is about the values of the justices, and here's what the values should be as we look to the Constitution for the future.
Republicans, in my view, are operating in an anti-democratic manner. The demographics are against them, et cetera, et cetera. Even leaving aside Trump's attacks on norms and institutions, including the press, the Justice Department, and so on, there's the party's voter suppression. Now the programs of lame duck state legislatures to weaken or undermine Democratic office holders elected in the recent midterms, to make their hold over the office through gerrymandering and these other things overextend beyond their popularity among the citizenry. Does the Constitution offer us protections against these sort of actions?
Sometimes, and sometimes not. Let's give some examples of not. The Electoral College. The Electoral College is incredibly anti-democratic. There's no other democracy in the world where the person who loses the votes for the highest office could then be deemed to be elected. And yet Donald Trump lost by 3 million votes, and yet because of the Electoral College president. There's no solution for that, really, without amending the Constitution. There's certainly some ways in which we can lessen the effects of the Electoral College. The United States Senate. Every state has two senators, regardless of its size. That's tremendously anti-democratic. I don't think there's a way of solving that without a constitutional amendment. On the other hand, partisan gerrymandering is a practice that I think the Supreme Court should declare unconstitutional, and it is a way in which a minority can entrench itself and gain control over government. In North Carolina, a purple state, Barack Obama carried it in 2008, Romney in 2012, Trump in 2016, Republicans got a slight majority of the seats for the state legislature, then drew legislative districts to give them safe seats in a supermajority of the districts and a control of 10 of 13 congressional districts. That should be unconstitutional.
Now, one of the things that you allude to, certainly in talking about the Senate and also applies to the Electoral College, is the urban-rural divide, which it seems to me, in an effort to get the Constitution passed, the original signers kind of enshrined in the Constitution, and it has only in the 21st century and the late 20th century begun to really show how how enormous this distinction is, that we seem to have one country reside in our cities, and that's the country of, you know, of immigration, of technological innovation, et cetera, of progressive thoughts about gender and so on. And then the rural, very different. What do you think that means for the future of this country?
I think it's part of a deep polarization. I think our country is more polarized than it's been at any time since Reconstruction. I think the question is, can a country that's this polarized, where there's such antipathy between the two sides, function in the long term as a nation? And if not, what can cure the polarization? I don't have a good answer for either of those.
Okay, and yeah, that's sort of what scares me too, is that I see the problems confronting us, whether it's climate change, technological disruption, are almost existential problems for us as human beings and as members of a society. And in this fractious, divided, partisan atmosphere we're in, I'm afraid we're not up to solving them, and that scares me. You have laid out that the reason you wrote this book is to call attention to the agenda of the Republicans vis-a-vis the Supreme Court and vis-a-vis the judiciary, and to call Democrats to wake up and take on some sort of a similar approach. And you point out that that you sort of begin from the preamble of the Constitution in sort of making that argument. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, it is. The Republicans and conservatives realized decades ago, when they did not have control of the court, that they needed a long-term strategy. And it needed to include articulating a conservative vision for constitutional law. They did that. Now they have justices to implement it. I'm urging progressives to do the same thing. And that's why I wrote this book. And we have to start with, what are the underlying values of the Constitution? And it's striking to me how much you find them in the preamble of the Constitution. It says that the Constitution exists to create democratic governance, to ensure that it's effective governance, to establish justice, to secure liberty. And the value that I'd add to it, that's not mentioned in the preamble, is equality. And what I want to argue in the book is, take each of these values and let's think about how to embody them from a progressive standpoint.
Okay, and I'm going to, just for time's sake, I'm going to read some quotes from you about the way that this conservative agenda has embodied itself. These are quotes on a few issues. Few issues so closely correspond to ideology and political party affiliation as the meaning of the Second Amendment. From 1791 until 2008, the Supreme Court never invalidated any law as violating the Second Amendment. And then in June 2018, the Supreme Court dealt a severe blow to you. In June of 2018, they did so.
The case that struck down a law for violating the Second Amendment for the first time was June of 2008. It was District of Columbia versus Heller.
And then in June 2018, the Supreme Court dealt a severe blow to unions by holding that non-union members cannot be required to pay the share of the union dues that support the collective bargaining activities of the union. Liberals see the Establishment Clause, the establishment of separation of church and state, as, in the words of Thomas Jefferson, creating a wall separating church and state. Conservatives interpret this provision narrowly as only prohibiting the government from establishing a church or coercing religious participation. So we've talked guns, unions, church and state. In a series of ideologically divided 5-4 decisions with Justice Scalia in the majority, the Supreme Court in recent years has greatly protected businesses at the expense of injured consumers and employees. And the Roberts Court has been the most pro-business court since the mid-1930s, virtually always in 5-4 rulings. So unions, business, guns, religion. So there's a clear movement in the conservative direction over the last few years. How would, and you've said briefly and for those who want to check, I mean, starting in the 70s, really, the conservatives began a program, as you said, their long term, their long plan of nurturing college students, law school students, young clerks, and so on, the Federalist Society, moving people up through the Brett Kavanaughs of the world, the Neil Gorsuches. How do you imagine a counter program from the Democratic or progressive side?
To start with, I think we need to articulate what is that progressive vision of the Constitution? What do we want the Constitution to be about? And so take the values that I talked about, democratic governance. Well, I think we need to figure out how to reform the Electoral College. We need to figure out how to deal with racism in voting and disenfranchisement. We need to deal with partisan gerrymandering. We need to think about what's the progressive vision in terms of separation of powers. We need to really look seriously at the criminal justice system, which is so biased against people of color, and figure out what would we do to create a fair criminal justice system. We need to think about liberty in terms of privacy, in terms of religious freedom. We need to talk about it in terms of equality and how do we create a law that really does provide for equal protection and ultimately provides for much more economic justice. And that's why I wrote this book, to try to say all of those things.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is that I think the progressives, Democrats, and so on, have been playing defense in judicial rulings, defense on the Supreme Court. And what you're saying is articulate a vision of what the values that America was founded on call for, and then. But still, once they articulate the vision, given the number of conservative young conservative justices that have been appointed by Trump, given the youth of Roberts, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, how does, after you articulate the vision, how do you actually begin to move that forward?
Hopefully it's by electing a Democratic president and a Democratic Senate. There will be vacancies, and additional seats can be created. Congress can expand the size of the lower federal courts, and we need to do that. And that would then allow the Democratic president, when there's one, to help counterbalance all of the judges that Trump has put there. And I think if there's a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress in 2020, then need to think about, should we expand the size of the Supreme Court to reclaim the seat that was really stolen as a result of the Merrick Garland fiasco?
Talk about that for a second. I would imagine that would be one of those, oh my God, this is, you know, the earth will turn on its axis. You know, things will. But there's nothing that says they can't do that, correct?
The number of Supreme Court justices is not set by the Constitution. It's set by a federal statute. It's varied over the course of American history between 5 and 10. Because of a historical accident, it became 9 in the late 1860s. But Congress could change that again. I think that's something that's premature to talk about at this point. I think for progressives to discuss it now is just a reason for people who might not otherwise vote in 2020 to come out for Republicans. But I think it's something that if the Democrats get the White House and Congress in 2020 that really needs serious consideration.
Okay. One of the things that some people have suggested is that the Supreme Court should give up judicial review. You take that on seriously, but you come down on the other side.
I do. It's tempting, in light of what the Supreme Court is and the lower federal courts are going to be, to say, let's just take the Constitution away from the courts. And yet I think about the people who I've represented. I've represented people on death row. I represented a homeless man challenging a Ten Commandments monument in Texas. I've represented a Guantanamo detainee. I've represented people challenging the sentence under three strikes. For my clients, it's really the courts are nothing. I've lost a lot of these cases, but when's the last time that a legislature adopted a law to provide more rights to criminal defendants? When's the last time a legislature adopted a law to give more rights to prisoners? And so I think that the Constitution is meant to protect minorities that aren't going to be protected through the political process. And if we eliminate the courts, we eliminate any chance of their having protection.
Erwin Chemerinsky, we've talked mostly here about the ideas in the book, We the People, of Progressive Reading of the Constitution for the 21st Century, your new book, and people can learn more at law.berkeley.edu. I've listened to a couple of speeches you've made recently on free speech, and I just think it's such an issue that is fraught, you know, that's in the public eye, that's fraught with emotion and so on. You point out that free speech only has to do with the government, and that there are three exceptions to free speech. Go ahead, just if you could give people that quick lesson.
First, free speech, like almost all constitutional rights, only limits what the government can do. So if somebody works for a public institution, a government institution, like I do at University of California, Berkeley, we have protection of free speech. But if somebody works for a private company or a private university, then the Constitution doesn't apply. There are many exceptions with regard to free speech where the Supreme Court has said that speech can be punished. Child pornography is not protected by the First Amendment. False and deceptive advertising. Incitement of illegal activity. Obscenity. True threats. And so on. I, in talking about college campuses, often focus on three, but there's more exceptions than that.
Okay. There are some people who call for a constitutional convention to handle some of these problems. Do you come down on one side of that or not?
I'm very frightened of a constitutional convention.
As am I.
What if the constitutional convention was comprised of, like the current Congress, an ideology? Or the majority was Trump voters, and I don't know how we'd prevent that. If there was such a constitutional convention, I think it would be a far worse document than what we have today. So in some ways, like here, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't.
Yeah. I mean, that same urban-rural divide, I think, would be the Constitutional Convention would just make that so absolutely clear, and you'd have sort of past America versus future America, and hell would be to pay. So again, you can learn more at law.berkeley.edu. Dean Chemerinsky's latest book is We the People, A Progressive Reading of the Constitution for the 21st Century. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net. That's terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually eight or so pretty relevant articles that flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at TEMCNALLY@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at iTunes. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to G, my engineer, Mark Maxwell, and Teddy Andrews in production, and George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all to you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Erwin Chemerinsky, and keep up your good work.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure to talk to you.